A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Meta, a podcast about podcasts. My name is Peter Wells, and today I'm joined by Fiona Reynolds, who has a very fascinating podcast. I've only heard a couple of grabs so far, but I love the concept. It is something that I've worried about many times when the media decides that you are the story of the day and you are the person who is the character of the day that they're focusing on, what that does to your life.
A young mother sets up camp with her family. A ski instructor drifts off to sleep beside his wife.
Night, hon.
A miner clocks on for a night shift underground. These ordinary Australians were about to face extraordinary events.
A full-scale search
that would be devastatingly traumatic and highly newsworthy.
To have been taken by a dingo.
A wall of mud and water buried two ski lodges shortly.
News just in, a rockfall has been reported at the Beaconsfield mine.
Not one anticipated danger and disaster, expected ongoing media and public attention, or imagined becoming an accidental celebrity.
So, Fiona, tell me about the show and the idea behind it.
Hi, Peter. The show really came from a thesis that I did as academic research while I was working as a media executive. I was director of at the ABC. And when I finished in that position and decided to stay home, get off the road with my family, I thought I'd better finish this PhD. And the idea sprang from really over my journalistic career over 30 years, I had reported on the Thredbo landslide. I had met Bruce and Denise Morecambe, whose son Daniel disappeared, shortly after his abduction while I worked for the Queensland Police Minister. And when I moved back to Tasmania in 2007, I reported on the first anniversary of the Beaconsfield rockfall. And in between, I had seen many, many people throughout the, that time suddenly go from being anonymous to an overnight headline. And their lives were then poured over. Their personal lives became public. And I'd started to wonder whether these people had anything in common, whether there were any similarities, and how their experiences may have differed. And so that's why I embarked on the research, because I just felt like I had this nagging question that I had to answer. And when I had completed the PhD, I was at home wondering what I was going to do next, because I'd thrown away this this great job, as an executive, to stay home, finish the PhD, and then went, what do I do now? And COVID hit, and I had the audio recordings, and I thought, really, this is something that people should hear. Mm-hmm. And there's no more powerful medium, really, than audio. And when you hear their voices and them telling them those stories, it resonates. So I thought, I'll go back to brushing off broadcast skills that I hadn't used for over 10 years, and I would learn about something that I had never actually worked in, and that was creating a podcast. And I was very fortunate to be linked up with some real professionals in this space who guided me through the process. So I, brushed off the vocal cords, got out the storytelling again, and that's produced this, resulted in this podcast.
We'll get to the people that you interviewed, because just even saying their names out loud immediately evokes images and their story. But before we do that, I'm curious as to who are the people that helped you create this.
Well, I spoke with a friend and said, I don't know where to start with a podcast in the commercial space, because my last role was with the ABC. And this friend said, oh, you need to speak with Paula Donovan, who was an investigative reporter for Channel 7, and she'd been involved in a couple of podcasts, most notably as well, Pendulum. And I rang Paula and just basically put in a cold call. Hi, Paula, you don't really know me, but I want to create a podcast. We met up, and when I went to meet her, she brought to the table Sally Eales, who had been instrumental in the podcast The Lady Vanishes, and Mark Wright, who's an audio editor who had also worked on both of those projects, Pendulum, Lady Vanishes and others. And they were incredibly generous in basically giving me what I would call the playbook. Right, you need a distributor, we'll link you up with a distributor. You'll need a lawyer, you know, to assist you in this process. You know, here's the audio editor, Mark. We can basically talk you through the process. And I said to them, you know, what's in it for you? You know? And they said, well, look, we had to learn all of this, and we're really happy to pass this on. And I've got to tell you that the entire way through, they have just been supportive, cheering me on. And I think that I have found this fantastic community in podcasting that I didn't even realise was there. You know, as an independent person, you're used to working in a work environment where you're surrounded by a team. And I found a team as an independent person, and it's made the road a lot easier and a lot less lonely.
That's incredible. How do you find a team like that? I mean, is this a service we can tap into?
Look, I even to the point where I didn't have a microphone at all. And I've got a friend in Launceston, Sue Bell, who said to me, oh, I've got a great podcast microphone. I'll loan that to you. She brought it around. She set it up in my daughter's bedroom for me to do the voiceovers. And I think it was Sue who called me the accidental podcaster, mm-hmm. because, you know, being in the garden wondering what the hell I was going to do next, you know, turns into I might do a podcast, but I don't know where to start, leads to this community of people who surrounded me and helped me through. And so I do actually genuinely feel like I've stumbled into this, and it's been a great joy. And I feel that after, you know, 10 years out of content making, it's given me something back in my soul, which is once you're a journalist, you know, from the age of 17, it's ingrained, and I feel like I've found that storytelling joy back again.
Well, that's great. And I can completely understand why people would want to attach themselves to this project, because, like I said, I get a lot of pitches every week, and this one really stood out to me as just such a fascinating story. It speaks to, I mean, obviously, as someone in the media, vaguely, I worry about kind of the media's impact on regular people's lives when things like this happen. So let's start talking about some of the guests. I can see the name that most people around the world would know is Lindy Chamberlain.
Yes. If there were a hierarchy of accidental celebrities in Australia, Lindy Chamberlain Creighton would be absolutely at the top of the list, you know, 40 years after Azaria disappeared. The term accidental celebrity was actually coined by three Australian academics, Graham Turner, Francis Bonner and David Marshall, and it was used to describe people who, through a high-profile news event, become public figures. And their personal lives, once their personal lives become well-known as opposed to a professional achievement, then they're an accidental celebrity. And that's exactly what happened with Lindy. And I think people really believe that they know her story so well. Mm. I was interested to see whether people felt there was something new to learn or not. I can assure you that Lindy agreed to participate in my academic study because she said she saw the list of questions and thought, I really actually haven't been asked these before, because the media rarely reports on the media. Mm. And people haven't really asked me what it's like to be a public figure when I feel like an ordinary person. To have that, as she says, you know, taken away from her is, you know, her privacy and her anonymity is a nuisance. So I was thrilled when Lindy agreed to be part of that. And then she's just been, from the get-go, so supportive right through into the podcast series. And I do think that people will learn actually quite a bit more about Lindy's experience. They know about the event. They don't know what it's like to be in the spotlight.
Yeah. Yeah, I've listened to one of the audio grabs of Lindy that you sent me, and it's fascinating to hear her become almost a media commentator, because she can see, she says that, you know, I can see that person is about to go through what I went through.
And that's sort of almost surprised me too, is that I reflected on it and thought, wow, she knows so much about how the media operates, and then thought, of course she knows so much about how the media operates. She's been in it for 40 years. Mm. There would be nothing probably that Lindy doesn't know, hasn't learned about spoiler stories and deals that are done. And she's actually learned, you know, taught me quite a bit along the way, I've got to say, from her perspective. She read the thesis, she read the script, both for the podcast series forensically. And I said to her, oh, it's like having your fingernails pulled out but sort of enjoying it, because she'd say, no, it's sort of more like this. And she was, she is incredibly insightful. And her observation is that when you know that you can, that somebody reaches out to you, you know what they're going through, she said, and they ask you for help, you help them because you know what hell it is.
Mm. So does that mean that Lindy Chamberlain is actually getting calls from someone like a Stuart Diver saying, what on earth is happening to me? Or like, well, are these conversations actually happening?
They do happen. They happen between the different people when they are particularly, I think, pointed in the direction of somebody else who's come before them by, I think, people like emergency services. For instance, Stuart Diver was asked to reach out and speak with Todd Russell because the emergency services said, look, we just don't know that he's aware of really what to expect coming up. But equally, the media does that too. So, you know, if an event happens, we will often go back to somebody who's been through it before and say, oh, what do you think that they're experiencing? What do you think that is in store for them? Not about the media experience, just about the survival, etc. So James Scott was asked to comment on Stuart Diver, and James says, I regret that now, because how would I know what it was like for Stuart Diver to be under a landslide for 65 hours? I was in Nepal for 43 days. It wasn't the same experience. Todd Russell has been asked numerous times by media to comment on mining disasters, and he said he did that a couple of times and then said, oh, I'm not going to do that anymore, because every mining disaster is different. They have a different outcome, and I really don't want to be a commentator in that space. But to go back to your question about Lindy, yeah, she said that she is approached by people who say, please, can you give me some advice? And she will help them. But she said what she won't do is insert herself in somebody else's trauma. So Lindy doesn't go around, you know, tapping people on the shoulder saying, hey, I see that you're in the news, can I help? That's not what she does. But if she's approached, she'll help.
That's amazing. You would imagine that there's support for people going through something like this that emergency services would provide. But what can you do? You know, there is such a very tiny amount of people who would ever experience the full picture of suddenly becoming a celebrity when they have no other reason to be one apart from something incredible happening to them.
And there's a number of ingredients that go into that, because, as you know, Andy Warhol's famously said that people experience 15 minutes of fame. And for most people, that's what happens. We see trauma every week become a news headline, and most of those people have 15 minutes in the spotlight and they disappear again. But there are some where the coverage was so blanket, so sustained, ongoing and deep, nationally and even internationally, that we get to feel as audiences that we know them. Mm. And we're curious about what happens to them next. And then the media pops it in their diary for check in with them on the anniversary of the Rockfall and see how they're going now, and that generates another story. And when they participate in that, that keeps the coverage going and they stay in the spotlight. So in Lindy's case, for instance, 40 years, and she doesn't look like what she looked like 40 years ago, but we all know what Lindy Chamberlain looked like because we've watched her age and change over the years. And I think it's that kind of repetition. They all recognise that they participated in coverage and they contributed to their profile. Whether they feel they actually had a choice in that or not is debatable. Some actively sought the media. The Morecambes certainly did. They say that if Daniel's body had been found within the first 2 days, they would never have done any media interviews. But they were advised to reach out to the media because the media was the best avenue of getting public attention to try and help find him. And ultimately they believe, on the positive side, that it is the media that helped with police and the public in solving his crime, the murder of Daniel. And Rosie Batty, you know, nobody expected in the media contingent that Rosie would actually walk out and talk to the media. Now, she says she intended to go out and say, please respect my privacy, but when they said, would you like to comment, she did. And she spoke and everybody was silent and they couldn't believe that this was the mother of Luke Batty, who'd been murdered by his father, speaking to them on her street. And so clearly... and then that led to invitations to speak again about family violence that she had raised there. And she, it really became, one interview became two, became three, became four, and it grew from there. And she became, you know, the face of family violence.
Yeah, I mean, her story is a really interesting one because, like you say, she went from being a victim to an advocate, and part of that was almost embracing the media to an extent to make that happen. What about the people who find themselves with fictionalized accounts of their story coming out? What were the comments that someone like a Lindy or a Stuart Diver said about being portrayed by Meryl Streep, or having, you know, the worst moment of your life turned into an entertaining miniseries? I can't imagine what that experience must be like.
Well, I think from the beginning, there is the general media representation of people. So, you know, there's a couple of things there. First of all, it's their interactions with the media, and there's quite a lot of discussion about that, about the death knocks, the stakeouts, the, you know, the various aspects that go into that, the potential crossing of the line of ethical behaviour, et cetera, in order to try to get the story. They talk about that. But they also then talk about, okay, how was I actually portrayed in the media or represented in the media? And they all feel that it doesn't necessarily align with how they feel about themselves. So their self-image isn't necessarily the same as what their public image is. In the case of Stuart Diver, he feels that he was, from the beginning, lifted, elevated to being this hero, and that forever people will feel that he is this hero. And he said, I'm not that person. I cry. I didn't cry on camera, and he takes responsibility for the fact that he chose not to, and he chose not to cry because he felt that if he, you know, there were all of these people who had died and their families, and if they saw him crying, he actually survived. So he thought the response, you know, the right thing to do is to not cry. But then he was portrayed as either being hard and too tough, or the hero who was larger than life, stronger. And then, of course, that's then exacerbated by having a miniserial or television documentaries or films done about you, is it gets reinforced. So in some respects they do become a bit fictionalized and almost like characters in a drama. And that's a very strange thing. So, you know, in Lindy's case, She said Meryl Streep had watched an awful lot of interviews about her, everything that she could lay her hands on. And when she actually met Meryl Streep, Meryl Streep talked with her for about 15 minutes and said words to the effect of, damn, I have to go back to the drawing board because you're nothing like what I thought you were. You are so much more complex. Mm. You laugh and you cry and I thought you were this particular person and now I'm going to have to try and get, you know, deeper. And that's what they all say is, I'm not black or white. I'm not... a hero or a villain. I'm not, you know, a victim or necessarily just, you know, a survivor. I am a complex human being who's been through an experience.
Yeah, and that seems to be the issue of the media is that it's not really good at telling complex stories, especially in 30-second grabs. And so what ends up happening in that place of telling a multifaceted character with various motivations. Instead, you generally, most of these survivors get, you know, placed in two buckets. There's the saint and the hero bucket that clearly no human being can live up to, or there is the you weren't emotional enough bucket. Why, you know, you experience this trauma and regardless of whether you're still in shock or whatever it is that Stuart Diver deciding that he didn't have the right to be emotional and therefore changed the way he approached the media, then you end up with, they're the two characters you can play in this situation.
And sometimes they play both.
Yeah.
Depending on what the story is or what the angle to the coverage is. You know, that leads then into them really having to contemplate how they're seen publicly. Now, they all recognise that the public also generally wants that sort of persona. So why is the public, you know, curious about people who have been through trauma and survived it? We're curious about survival and struggle and adversity and how on earth did somebody endure 65 hours, you know, underground? How did somebody endure 43 days lost in the Himalayas? We want to know how somebody does that. Then we get fascinated too with the strength of the human spirit. And that, you know, causes us to want to know a little bit more about the person, the individual, what makes them tick. Once you're then in that space and you are this public figure, every one of them has worried about how then people perceive them when they go out in public. They try to go along with their lives and just try to lead ordinary lives again. But the Morecambes talk about how they don't feel like they can go to the supermarket and dump their trolley next to their car. They have to go back and put it back in the bay because otherwise somebody's going to say, that was the Morecambes, they did the wrong thing. Or Lindy goes to the doctor's surgery and an old magazine's sitting there and she's in it. And she goes, I just tried to bury that underneath the pile. Stuart Diver still works at Thredbo and he'll walk along and he'll see people and they'll go, are you Stuart Diver? Well, yes, I've got Stuart Diver on my name tag and I'm at Thredbo. He said, I sometimes wonder how many Stuart Divers do they think are in Thredbo? But that is a feeling then of what if I do something wrong? You know, what if I'm seen to not be perfect? I'm perceived by people to not be what they thought that I was. And Todd Russell in particular he says he doesn't really care that much about what people think of him, but at the same time he says, I'm concerned that people, if I do the wrong thing or I'm seen to be doing the wrong thing, that these days with mobile phones and social media, somebody will capture that and I'll be like the footballer who ends up, you know, a viral star for doing something wrong.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And did any of them talk about any kind of therapy or any kind of, I don't know, CBT or acceptance therapy or whatever that actually helped them get past this idea that the rest of the world is judging them and they need to live up to unrealistic expectations?
Not about that specifically, but they're quite open about, for instance, Stuart Diver talks very openly about having worked with a psychologist, you know, for quite some time after the landslide to try to comprehend what had happened and how he was going to continue on after that. Todd Russell talks about how, you know, the mental effects of the rock fall were just as bad, really, if not worse, than the physical effects of it. For the most part, they describe themselves, most of them, as survivors, not victims, and they don't want self-pity. And Rosie's very clear on that. I don't want people to pity me, and I don't have self-pity. I've been somebody who's been through an experience. I'm on a journey, and I just need to keep going. The Morecambes really have difficulty with people coming up and saying and giving them a lot of condolences, because it puts them back in the space that they were in before. Most of them they're quite happy, though, generally, for people by and large to recognise them in a positive way. So not in a pitying way, but in a, hey, you're Rosie Batty, aren't you? And she said, and I'm delighted if people actually are excited to see me rather than feeling like they need to go and hide, because how would you talk with somebody who's lost their son in such dreadful circumstances?
And what were some of the universal themes that kind of came through for you? You know, I've never been lost on the Himalayas, but I've done things that in my time I've looked back and regretted, and or I've felt the, you know, the social stigma of doing something wrong at times that feels like, you know, the very tiniest whiff of what some people could be going through in this situation. Are you able to, do you reflect on the kind of the universal themes that you're hearing?
I did as a part of my thesis work. In this podcast series, though, I have very much focused on letting them tell their story of their media and public attention and the experience and what that was like. So that's really been the focus for each one of them. But I think if you listen to the series, you will, all the different episodes, you'll hear the themes come through. It's really clear about how they were approached and pursued. And that is quite a common theme. It's also about how their stories were told, how they were represented. Interestingly enough, I think I had to personally confront some of those issues of having been a journalist and you know, my past practices, which I like to think my humanity was intact and that I behaved, you know, ethically. But I also have had to confront the fact that I helped turn a lot of people into celebrities, accidental celebrities, whether they wanted to be or not. And I think that the universal theme that comes through is actually one of control, and it's about the wrestle for control over their interactions with the media and the public, and also then how they were portrayed and represented. And that leads to a very interesting discussion really about issues like employing agents and checkbook journalism. Two of the most controversial things that the media likes to talk about, especially if they're outing the practice of another.
Yeah, I was going to say.
is, oh, they've, you know, that person's employed an agent and now this network over here has paid for the exclusive. But what you'll hear from those who have employed agents and participated in checkbook journalism, which is, you know, specifically Lindy, James, Stuart and Todd, is that it was never about the money first. They weren't trying to make money out of their own situation. They needed some sense of control over the pack the demands that were placed on them, everybody who wanted to talk to them. So getting an agent, hiring somebody, helped them basically keep people at bay. And the reason for going into an exclusive arrangement was because instead of having to talk to multiple people and go back over and over and over the same issues, they were able to deliver a clear message through one, and then everybody else got the message to back off. And that, if that entails money, so be it. And none of them make an apology for accepting money. Lindy talks about how sometimes she's done contracts, very, very small amounts of money, but it was actually about the control. And sometimes the money just gets attached to, that's why it's an exclusive. But equally, you know, she said, I've become so well known now, I can't get a job. I haven't been able to get a job. So everybody else has made far more money out of me than what I've ever made out of myself from selling a few stories. And they all agree with that.
Yeah, yeah. The final question I have is, the media has certain rules when it comes to reporting about certain things, like suicide is discussed in a way that is designed not to create copycats and not to encourage other people.
You generally either say it was a suicide and you don't talk about the method.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. So you know, if it's a famous person and you can't escape it, then you will say death by suicide. But if it's a non-famous person, then it's generally there were no suspicious circumstances. It's that kind of wording. Anyway, the point is, the media has very strict guidelines about this, or at least, you know, it is formulated ways of doing this. If you were to create a media handbook today for journalists who are reporting on accidental celebrities, how would you structure that playbook? And by the same idea, if you were to write a playbook for someone who discovers they have now become an accidental celebrity, what would be some of the key things you would tell them to do so that they don't become vilified, or that they don't become a saint, or that they don't, you know, that they can control the way their story is told?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I'm not the font of all wisdom here in this regard, but what
You're
I would
doctor.
Say as far as...
Come on.
Yes, but as I like to say, I'm only qualified to diagnose a bad news story. I would say, look, to the media, you really have to keep coming back to the principles of having some empathy and understanding and respect for the individuals involved, and try not to get engaged in the pack mentality and the pack pursuit. Give people some space. Now, everybody wants the story, but I think you have to come back to saying under what circumstances are they prepared to talk, and how can we help facilitate that and give them some level of control over that. You know, there are clearly things that happen that are not ethical, but by and large, most journalists are. They will always get, in any industry, I think, unethical behaviour, and we'd be silly if we didn't think so. But, you know, when I've done Death Knock before, you know, I went there, yes, I did, but I also gave the person some space to decide whether they wanted to speak or not, and when they said they didn't want to, I left. I didn't pursue them, try and take photos, do surreptitious things like that. So I think we have to come back to what our own code of conduct says, and it's very clear what the media code of conduct is in Australia, and we should be following what our code says, because it's written by journalists and for a reason, to control those behaviours. And in terms of the people themselves, if I were, you know, I've thought about this, you know, how I wouldn't, after 30 years in the media, I wouldn't be prepared for the sort of situation that these people experienced. And they didn't have the knowledge of the media. So I think I would like to echo what James Scott says, who has been through it, and he's a psychiatrist, and he says, if you can avoid the media, try to, but by and large, when it's something like this is going to happen, you're not going to be able to. So give yourself the time and the space to think about how you're going to engage with the media and what you want to say, what your message is. So how you will interact and what your message will be. And if you need to get some advice from somebody else, get some advice before you do.
Yeah. Yeah, since we started recording, I've been trying to figure out what I would do in this situation as well. I know I wouldn't be thinking straight, so none of what I say today makes any difference anyway. But I would like, I think probably the best idea would be to, like you say, keep the media at as far distant as possible, and that does probably mean selling a story as an exclusive, but then making sure that the money goes to a charity or something so that you can never be accused of profiting off your own trauma.
I think it's very much, I'd leave it to the individual as to what they would want to do with the money. I think that that's their choice. One thing that I think that the media probably could do when it comes to the issue of payments is, instead of sneering and sniping about somebody paying for a story, you know, there is the potential for the media to just say this story was, you know, exclusive payment, but you don't have to say how much is in the contract, but you declare that. And I know that those who miss out will always feel aggrieved by it, but we can be upfront. We should just be more upfront about that. Don't you think that that might stop that sort of debate about, are they going to do a financial deal, and when are they going to do a financial deal? And
I'd love to believe so, but I just don't, you know, maybe I watched too much Frontline but in my formative years, but I just kind of feel that, you know, no matter who you decide to go with, then you're just making everyone else decide that you've sold out.
Yeah.
Unless you, I don't know, maybe giving like an exclusive to the ABC and then just walking away and asking for, I don't know. Again, these are all hypotheticals I hope to never have to think about.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the public broadcasters, you know, don't spend money on exclusives. They'll pay expenses for people and things like that, which is another form of payment, but they won't pay, you know, shell out cash for an interview. We know that. But let's get back to it. We're all in the pursuit of audiences. So in getting an exclusive, they're still getting audiences, which then the objective of that is to justify the funding that they get from government. So everybody is just after the audiences, and that's why they make put a value on that exclusive. Was it worth it or not?
Yeah.
I don't have the answer to that, other than I came into this being against checkbook journalism for ethical reasons that I felt like perhaps it encourages people to embellish their story, or, you know, it's stopping the free flow of information, which is another argument about it, that you're limiting it to one outlet. Journalists, you know, will report on what other, you know, on those exclusives anyway, across outlets. And I've come to the conclusion that really from the perspective of these people, I'd be doing it, and it would be to, you know, and they all say, I didn't need money to embellish my story. That's these a specific group of trauma survivors. They don't need money to embellish their story, and they don't embellish their story in order to get that. It was very much about control and protection.
Completely understandable. Well, I can't wait to listen to the series because, yeah, it ticks all of the boxes of, like, weird niches that I'm totally into. So thank you so much for making it, Fiona, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Peter.
And sorry, just one more time, what is the show called, and where can people find it?
The show is called Accidental Celebrity, and it's available on Acast, Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want a bit more information, you can go to accidentalcelebrity.com.au.
Fantastic. Thanks so much.
Thank you.